Welcome to the Franziska Show podcast on JewishCoffeeHouse.com, the show where I give a voice to Jewish issues, topics, and people. I'm Franziska Frady, your host. Thanks for tuning back in. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast. And if you enjoy it, please share this podcast with a friend or family member. Share it on your social media. This is how you help grow the show. This is a Jewish Coffeehouse podcast, and here we go. Welcome to the Franziska Show, Rav Scott Kahn. It's great to have you on once again.
It is a pleasure to be with you today. Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored.
Well, I'm excited to have you on as a solo guest this time because we can spend a little more time on your personal background as well as what you do and then your thoughts on a lot of different controversial areas in today's day and age. So thank you.
My pleasure. Looking forward to it.
Let's start off. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background. I know you are a rabbi, Jewish Coffee House podcast founder and host of several podcasts. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I grew up in Boston, Massachusetts, and I went to the Maimonides School there, which is the school founded by Rav Soloveitchik, a classic co-ed modern Orthodox school. After that, I spent time both in Yeshiva in Israel, also Brandeis University in the United States. And I made Aliyah, or moved to Israel, I should say, when I was 25 years old in 1996. And then I met my wife here, Aliza, about 6 months later, and we got married, and we've been here ever since. She had already moved to Israel about 10 years earlier with her family. And I made Aliyah soon after I got married. That's why I moved to Israel in 96, but I made Aliyah a couple of years after that in 99, I think. Anyway, we have seven children, live in Ramat Beit Shemesh, and I used to run a yeshiva for 11 years. I was the co-rosh yeshiva of a place called Yisodei HaTorah, located right near Beit Shemesh, which is a yeshiva which was founded on the principle of trying to teach people learning skills as well as helping them develop, I hope, an independent Torah hashkafa, meaning that each person should learn how to think for themselves as opposed to simply imbibe that which was taught them. Teaching should be an opportunity for people to be able to run with it themselves rather than just repeat that which they already heard from their teachers. So given that, we had a good time doing it. The yeshiva closed approximately 9 years ago. And ever since then, I've been working in this field, the same field that you work in, working in podcasting. And now I do podcasting full time, both hosting my own as well as producing for other people.
And can you tell us why the yeshiva closed or how did that come about?
Yeah, that's a good question. The yeshiva closed. We simply didn't get enough students our last year. We were always a small yeshiva. By our fourth year, we were open for 11 years. By our fourth year, we were growing. And then our fifth year, we grew some more. We thought we were going to go over the top. And then our sixth year, we went back down again. And at that point, my co-rosh yeshiva, Rabbi Pesach Wolicki, who had his first grandson today, so mazal tov to him, he and I realized that, and he realized probably before I did, that once we started going down in numbers, that we eventually were not going to be able to stay open. We were a yeshiva that had a very high faculty-student ratio, meaning a lot of teachers per students and small classes, which meant that we had very high expenses too. And that meant that all it would take is 1 year with bad recruiting, and they could always happen. There was no wiggle room. There was no room for bounce that we could survive that. And that's exactly what happened. Our final year in recruiting after 11 years, we simply didn't get enough students the following year. In some ways, it was a bracha because it was clear that we couldn't open the following year. It wasn't as though it was a decision to make. Financially, it was impossible. So closing the yeshiva wasn't a choice. But it was also a bracha because both Rabbi Wolicki and I think, were pretty sure that we were burned out and were ready to do something else. So even though on some level I miss frontal teaching, I actually am happier doing what I'm doing now. And I am grateful that I had the opportunity to do that. And I don't regret a day. And I'm also grateful that I'm doing something different now.
And tell us, how did you get into podcasting?
That's an interesting question. I don't know the exact answer. I think it came down to the fact that growing up, I was always a radio person. I always used to love to listen to the radio as a kid. My dream was one day to be on the radio, have my own talk show. So that didn't happen. But once the yeshiva closed, I was looking for something to do and thinking about how could I do something which would give me both sipuka nefesh, a sense of personal satisfaction, along with hopefully making a living. Podcasts were becoming bigger then. This is again, 8, 9 years ago. And I said, that's really the modern version of radio. It's radio on demand. And the idea of getting involved in that really excited me. The idea of being able to reach hundreds or thousands or even more people was something which always just spoke to me. And it was a way of, even though you don't have that same frontal reaction when you're teaching in front of a room, the idea of speaking into a microphone and then it going out there and largely dependent on how good you are. That's the number of people who are going to listen to it. That was always a very exciting idea for me. And the idea that I could talk about my ideas, the ideas that hopefully other people would find important or that would resonate with them, was something which it really spoke to me. So it was a very exciting idea for me. Now, of course, as I became more involved, I realized this isn't quite as democratic as I thought. There's a lot of marketing. There's a lot of other things that go into making a podcast popular. It's not as simple as if you have the best podcast, then everyone's going to listen to you. It doesn't necessarily work like that. But at least in theory, there's no limit. If you have a podcast, there's nothing stopping 10 million people in principle from listening to it should that happen. And that was always a very exciting thing for me.
How did you decide what you'd podcast about?
Well, I started off podcasting on all different topics. I started off with some podcasts on business. I mean, I was hosting, I'm not an expert on business, but I hosted with somebody else, some on Israeli politics. I co-hosted with somebody who was a former Chavir Knesset, member of Knesset in Israel. I had a podcast called Scott Conversation, which was just about whatever topics I felt like talking about. And eventually, the two podcasts that seemed to stick, both in terms of what I found most important to me and what people found, I guess, most popular, were the podcast called Orthodox Conundrum, which is a weekly podcast which deals with issues in the Orthodox world, which I still podcast now, and something else, which is called Intimate Judaism. That's a podcast I co-host with Tali Rosenbaum, who's a sex and couples therapist. Tali and I did a podcast together, an episode. We decided to spin it off as a regular series. So Intimate Judaism became a monthly series that started off from that Orthodox Conundrum episode. And now it has about 60 episodes up there.
And you've been doing amazing work. And thank you for including me on the network as well.
Well, that's another part of it. It's been an honor to have podcasters like you who are doing great work and raising important issues in the Orthodox community as a member of that same network, which is called Jewish Coffee House. So I appreciate your joining it. So thank you.
Before we go into the topic for today, I just want to cover a little bit the space, and no one knows the back end of it, but me and you, and then there's 1840, there's Headlines and a bunch of other podcasts that we're sort of all doing the same thing, which is talking about topics that traditional Jewish media didn't or doesn't talk about. So are there anything that stands out that you'd want to share in terms of what you've learned over the years or boundaries that have been broken or expanded?
I'm not sure, but I would suggest that the most important fact is that we're talking about it at all. In other words, if someone were to ask me what the goal of either of my podcasts, Orthodox Conundrum or Intimate Judaism, is, it's less to convey information and more to open up conversations that otherwise wouldn't be taking place. The point isn't so much that the answer is in my head as that now we can talk about it. We can talk about things that previously were either taboo, particularly in the case of Intimate Judaism, which is about sex, but also issues in Orthodox Conundrum, which simply they might be anti-institutional or not the standard approaches or dealing with questions that people may otherwise not have wanted to talk about. And I know you do the same thing on your podcast, and 1840 does something similar as well. Each of us has our own attitude and our own specific ideas that we bring style. To that attitude, our own style. But ultimately, the most important thing to me is the fact that the conversations are taking place at all. And from the feedback that I've received, I think that there are a lot of people out there who want to have these conversations and who maybe feel disenfranchised on some level. They might feel that the institutions and organizations that currently exist, while well-meaning, often don't satisfy that which they were looking for. Not always, but at times. And I think that the podcasts, they're not a replacement for a community, of course, but they can sometimes create that feeling of, I'm not alone. There are other people who are talking about these same issues that are bothering me. And so people like you and me and others who are doing the same thing, hopefully are hitting a chord and making people feel less alone.
And it's creating new spaces that allow for conversations to happen that couldn't happen before.
Absolutely.
People ask me very often, how do you come up with your topics? So let me just throw my assumption onto you and let's see if it's the same.
Let me hear.
Your personal interests, anything that's coming up, you want to cover that, or somebody you meet, you're like, oh, that's interesting. Let's do that. And I can sort of follow, based on the podcasts I listen to, I can follow what the host is going through or what's happening in their life. And I'm sure people could say the same thing about me. So confirm, deny.
I definitely confirm 100%. I always wonder, like, based on the topics, people say, oh, I see what's bugging him today based on what I choose to talk about. But at the same time, Freddie, I have to say that it is always a difficult thing to get topics. Like, I always tell people content is a ravenous beast. It's very difficult to come up with things to talk about that aren't just going to retread other ideas. And even though there are always new topics that present themselves, I try to keep my podcast as fresh as possible, which means I usually record it within a few days before it actually comes out. And as a result of that, sometimes it will be Tuesday or Wednesday and the podcast comes out on Sunday night, Monday morning. And I'll be like, oh my gosh, I'll talk to my wife, Elise, and say, what am I going to talk about this week? I have no idea. Thankfully, I have always managed to come up with something, but it's always a struggle. And I always hope that people will give me feedback and suggestions because they're always, even if I don't use them at any given time, it's always good to hear because they spark ideas and sometimes I'll use them and sometimes I'll say, oh, not that, but something else. But I don't know. Do you find it difficult to come up with ideas? Because even though there's always things to talk about, I'm often struggling to figure out what to talk about right now.
I have a different strategy than you, whereas if a guest says yes, I'll take them as soon as they're ready to do it, even if I'm not ready to release it. So it ages my episodes a little bit, and that's not great. But at least I'm not stressed every week. It has happened several times, especially after the war. This episode, for example, is probably going to sit because I have a soldier who came out of Gaza. I promised him his episode is going to go live, and then we'll see what happens.
I have to say, I appreciate your method better, and I think it would be smarter if I did your method too. Just genuinely, I'm not just saying that, but that's how I do it right now. I think that your way is probably smarter.
Well, you do what works, and you've been consistent, so you have to keep going.
At the price of my blood pressure.
At the price of your blood pressure. Well, we all pay in one way or another.
That's true.
Have you gotten feedback from people you know, especially when you just started talking about more sensitive topics? Given you are a man and you have a rabbinic background, you know, Rosh Yeshiva background.
I thought there would be more pushback, especially with Intimate Judaism, because of what it is. Before I started Intimate Judaism with Tali, I should point out, I did speak to two of my rabbeim to make sure that from their perspective, I was doing something which was appropriate. I didn't want to do something that was halachically or otherwise dubious. And from both of them, I got a haskama of sorts saying that it was an okay thing to do. So in terms of my own confidence, I was able to put that in my pocket. Once I had that confidence, I was able to move forward. I expected there to be a lot of brushback and people being annoyed, and that has not been the case. It would be great to say, oh yeah, sure, I'm putting up with the slings and arrows all the time. Everyone hates it, and I'm so brave. It's not true. For the most part, I've only received positive reinforcement from that. So as much as it would be fun to say, oh yeah, sure, I have to put up with a lot, I really don't. There are people who disagree with what I say, but it's very rare that people will give me feedback which is fundamentally disrespectful and mean or bullying. Generally, some people agree, some people disagree. Most people who respond generally agree, and people who disagree usually do so in a very respectful way when we can have a dialogue. So that's been my experience.
Yeah. And I relate to that, expecting more pushback than getting. And I think it's because something's happening and people appreciate it, even if they disagree.
The institution, so to speak, tells us very often or implies that there's only a certain way to think about things. That's not necessarily representative of the Amcha.
Do you have some favorite topics, or you know that you talk about a specific topics, you're going to get lots of feedback or your downloads are going to get a boost?
It's funny you say that. I was just talking to someone about this about an hour ago, and the answer is I never really know. There are certain things that seem to do better than others, but I'm really bad at predicting it. There have been episodes that I was sure were going to do really well, and I was surprised that they weren't as popular as I'd anticipated. In other episodes, which I didn't think were particularly engaging, and they do quite well. And I don't really know what it is. There are certain topics that seem to do very well, like Tzniut. Whenever I talk about Tzniut, that seems to be a winner in terms of ratings. And there are certain topics that come out that I see now when we talk about, like, for example, the Haredi draft. Those have been doing quite well when I've talked about that recently. But in terms of anticipating it in advance, sometimes I've had one episode that did very well on a particular topic, and then I do a follow-up, and it doesn't do quite as well, and vice versa. So I'm really bad at determining what actually makes a good topic ratings-wise. So I have to really go with my gut and just do the best I can. And even if I wanted to purely do it based on what would work in terms of the most downloads, I'm not very good at figuring that out.
Well, I think everyone in this space has to juggle that question. Everyone in media in general, not just podcasting. So,
have you found otherwise also, or do you have certain topics that work for you?
So there's the chat that you're on, and then there's the podcast. So anytime we could talk about get refusal or money or lack of money, child molesters, anytime there's big dramatic things and there's nowhere else to talk about it, somehow the chat finds its
right
activity.
They discover it. Sure. Absolutely.
But yeah, Sneas did very well. but we try to create new topics. So just repeating the same old thing, I don't know if that would fly. But yeah.
Right. I'm actually planning a Newt's Newt episode soon, only because I have one of my teachers, a teacher I'm very close with. He spoke under my chuppah when Elise and I got married. It's coming soon. He's actually coming to Israel. And he has a specific curriculum in Tznut, which was never implemented, but that he designed it under the auspices of Rabbi Twersky Zatzal from Maimonides. And it was a type of Rabbi Twersky-based attitude towards Tznut. So we're going to do something about that soon. It's hopefully something new.
Let's talk about the theme that you just said has been doing well, the draft. And specifically why I invited you today is to talk about the dynamic between Dati parents and Haredi parents, where one side has their children literally on the line and the other side, you know, they may be learning Torah or doing or baking extra, whatever it is, but their children's lives aren't on the line. And there's that big, if I could have one takeaway from my trip to Israel last month, it was being in that dynamic. Outside of Israel, it was the diaspora Jews versus the Israeli Jews. And then when you go to Israel, it's Haredim versus the Dati Lumi. At least the environment I was in, that was one of the biggest emotional bubbles I was revolving around. And you have been covering this topic several times since the war started, maybe even before. And I know your son just started the army post October 7th, and you have one son-in-law in the Miluim. Every time I listen to you on your podcast and you get a little heated, I want to say, I want to hear from you. I want to know what do you feel? So here we are. Tell us everything.
First of all, I appreciate the question. And it is an interesting topic because I'll preface it by saying that there's a lot of talk all the time about unity in Israel and Achdut and how we're all together. And that's true. And I really appreciate that. And I don't want to deny it. At the same time, sometimes over-talking about and overemphasizing unity, I feel and I fear, is a way for entrenched powers to maintain their power, whether it's in politics or religion. And sometimes I fear that the people most talking about the importance of unity are people who don't want things to change. So for example, that gets to the Haredi Dati Leumi dynamic, where some of the people saying, oh, you know, unity is so beautiful. I hear that coming a lot more from people in the Haredi world than I do necessarily in the people in the Dati Lumi world. Now, by definition, Freddie, anything I talk about is my own anecdotal and small experience. I'm in Ramat Beit Shemesh, which is a pretty good place to learn about that because there are people who are from the Dati Lumi community and the Haredi world. I mean, even on my own block, it's mixed like that. But at the same time, it's not representative of all of Israel and certainly not of all of world Jewry. But I can only tell you my own experience. I have a feeling that people in the Dati Lumi community are getting more frustrated when they see their children being drafted, their children on the front lines, their children, lo aleinu, being injured and killed, and people in other communities refusing to serve. And as much as the idea of we're all in this together is true and it sounds good, it's starting after 5 months of this war to ring a little bit hollow for some of us. And it's hard to respect any sort of comparison between people making barbecues or baking cookies, and someone else going and fighting on the front lines and putting his or her life in danger. So I think that there is more frustration that is starting to bubble up underneath that unity. And I know from talking to people and from my wife talking to people that we're not alone. People are starting to really feel that there's something fundamentally unfair about a system where some people simply are not contributing in the same way as other people. Now, I know life isn't fair. And the fact is, I have three sons and two of them did not serve. They both have medical exemptions, and they would have served. They had medical exemptions, so they didn't in the end. So life, that's not fair either. But there's a difference between a group of people who institutionally refuse to serve, and on an individual level, there's always reasons why this person does or does not. But institutionally, that an entire community looks at themselves as exempt, a lot of us find that really problematic, and I'm one of them.
When you say frustrations, where does that show up?
I'm not sure where it shows up in terms of practical on the street talking to people. Certainly when I'm talking to neighbors or friends who are in the Haredi world who are not part of the Dati Lumi serving in the army group, I don't start yelling at them. I don't start expressing disapproval or disagreement with them. But at the same time, in conversations, it sometimes does come up. Like, for example, you mentioned that I've mentioned this and talked about this on my podcast. So somebody whose kids do not serve, listened to one of those podcasts. And we had a conversation about it coming home from shul one day. And we talk often about whatever we talk about. We're friendly, we schmooze. And this particular conversation was a little more defensive on his part. Like I didn't raise the topic. He wanted to talk about it. And one of the things which I had mentioned in that particular podcast was that this idea that it's been used by many people in the Haredi world. I don't want to be too sweeping, but one of the excuses is they don't want us anyway. They don't need us anyway. They have enough people. And that was something which was on some level true, but is no longer true because now they just extended the service from 2 years and 8 months to 3 years for people who are doing full service. For people in Miluim, like my son-in-law, I don't know how many days have been added to it, but a lot. It went from 40 to 45. And I think now every year instead of every few years, a lot of time has been added because they need more people. So this idea that we no longer need additional bodies, literally, on the front lines is simply not true. And he was bothered by that and was trying to defend on some level the status quo. He's like, is it really true? You know, I don't, you know. So in some ways, where does it manifest? In small interactions like that. On a regular basis, it's not coming up, but sometimes when people want to talk about it, you notice that one person gets defensive. Or for example, somebody else said to me at one point, we were talking, a nice guy whose kids are in yeshiva, he mentioned that, okay, you know, the kids in the Dati Lumi world are on the front lines and my kids are in yeshiva, we're all doing our part or something like that. So I didn't say anything because I didn't want to get into an argument, but when I came home, you know, it did sort of tear at me a little bit. Like, really? Do you really think that's equivalent? Is that really fair? Or one time, a different person had mentioned, this is probably back in November, towards the beginning of the war, when Israel had already taken over much of the north in Gaza, someone said something like, oh yeah, in Gaza, North Gaza, people are walking around in their t-shirts because, you know, it's basically, there's nothing, it's done now. First of all, that's not true. But even if it were true, I said to somebody, I didn't say who it was, but when I mentioned that someone had said that to me, I said, the only person who would ever suggest such a thing is somebody who doesn't have kids serving in Gaza. Because to say, oh, it's nothing, they're walking around t-shirts, it's great. Like, it's not great. No, it's not great. That's not what's going on. I'll say one more example. Someone once said to me, again, towards the beginning, he said, oh, is everything okay? I said, oh, someone was just killed in Gaza. That day, a soldier had been killed. And he goes, yeah, it's terrible. And he felt terrible. He goes, but the truth of the matter is, the numbers are really, really low altogether. And well, that might be true militarily. It's not for me to say what's low or not. My response to him was, well, for that family, their world has simply been shattered forever. So I can't think of it like that. And I said again to my wife, only someone who doesn't have kids in the army would say the numbers are low. One person is too high. It's just, you can't think like that. So I think it's more in small interactions that take place every day. That's where it comes up rather than in some big fight or in some big arena or in some big conversation. It's more just the way we might put up our guard or feel triggered by something that someone says innocuously.
Is there any family dynamics?
In terms of my own family?
Yeah. Do you have Haredi cousins?
So I don't have Haredi cousins. Aliza does have Haredi cousins, although her Haredi cousins don't live in Israel. I think the main difference in the family dynamic is less, I shouldn't say that. It's partially Haredi, non-Haredi, but it's also being in Israel and outside of Israel. And we both have family outside of Israel. My siblings all live outside of Israel. My parents live outside of Israel. I think that the way I think of it myself is that, and I've said this before, emotionally, Israel is closer than ever, but experientially, we have a much bigger gap. People who are not in Israel simply don't understand what the day-to-day life is like here. And Freddy, I don't know what your experience was like when you came to Israel in terms of feeling that, because I know some people come to Israel and they feel deeply enmeshed in that sense of tension and grief and pressure of what it's like. And other people simply have a different experience. I spoke to one person who said, yeah, I feel like people think about it more in America than here, which is, by the way, completely not accurate, but he was certainly in a specific place. He was in, like, he was going to certain places and he saw different things than what most people, he was seeing maybe tourist Israel and not real life parents with kids in the army or parents whose kids are hostages or whatever Israel. So I feel that gap is very big. And for sure, I definitely think that's a reality that we have to contend with, that whether it's with family or whether it's with friends who are not in Israel, people in Israel are going through a different way of looking at things. I'll use one example. A friend of mine who wishes he were in Israel very much. He deeply wishes he were here. He was saying that he can't be like an Israeli. He said to me, I think about Israel 100 times a day, but I'm not in Israel. And I thought that was a very astute statement. And the way I thought about it afterwards was He thinks about Israel 100 times a day. A lot of us in Israel don't think about Israel 100 times a day, meaning his baseline is not thinking about Israel, and he thinks about it all the time. Our baseline is always thinking about it, and sometimes we don't think about it. It's just a different perspective, a different way of coming at the issue.
To the point where when you go to Simcha in Chutz Laaretz, you feel guilty that you're celebrating something happy. And then when you're in Israel celebrating at Simcha, I think it's like, okay, good. We have to focus on the good things going on because there's so much bad. It's like anything positive that can be happening is helpful and is good. And anytime we can not be thinking about the situation is helpful.
Right. Maybe so. You know, I was actually visiting my parents about 2 weeks ago in Florida, and in their shul, they had at Kiddush, like a cholent cook-off where they had, like a game where there were four different cholents and everyone could taste the different cholent and decide which one they wanted. I don't begrudge them that. That's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong about doing that. But I said to Aliza, there is no way in the world a shul in Israel would have that right now. It's just no one's in that place to have a fun activity like a cook-off. There's nothing wrong with it. And I wasn't saying they were doing anything wrong, but to me, it expressed not a moral or ethical wrong, but rather a different mindset, a difference in mindset. Their mindset was, we're having our annual cholent cook-off. In Israel, no one's going to have it. We don't know how Purim is going to be. What's that going to be like? No one knows. Because then we halachically are mandated to sort of do those fun things. But absent a halachic mandate to do so or requirement, the idea of having just a fun activity in shul for no reason other than it's fun, I just don't see that happening here.
Well, they're always making events for Wives of Miluim and, trying to make it fun.
But that's in the context of the war. Wives of Miluim, barbecues for soldiers. The war is the background. Just an event for the sake of an event, because, hey, cholent is fun. Let's have a cholent cook-off. I can't imagine that happening here. It's not possible.
I thought it was very interesting. I don't remember the names, but you had this episode and you asked a question. It was a panel about Israel. It was the diaspora angle. And you asked, does Israel personally impact you? Does this directly impact you? Or is this, an idealistic fight for you? Or is this a real thing? There's just practically distance geographically. I felt validated by the question and shocked by some of the responses because I thought it was obvious that everyone feels the same way, but it's not.
Yeah, it's not. I think it's interesting because to me, originally, that question came from something I think I had asked on Facebook. I'm trying to remember. And I didn't even mention it as a question. I think I was discussing people taking vacations and fancy vacations and showing off on Facebook or whatever, and how I found it distasteful at this time. I said, if you're going to take your vacation, keep it quiet. It's not nice when people are suffering so much in Israel, they're hostages, all these terrible things are happening. And to be like, hey, here I am in Bermuda, look at me. Regardless of whether the look at me is ever a good thing, it's particularly distasteful at this time. That's what I was saying. And I mentioned that we're fighting for you too. And some people took issue with that. They go, I don't think you're fighting for me. And I was shocked by that because admittedly, I have an Israel-centric approach because I lived here. I've lived here for 28 years. But the idea that someone would think that Israel, if Israel weren't here, it would be sad, but it wouldn't be like, I'm not sure what they would say. Like, if Israel weren't here, my Judaism would basically be the same, just it would be sad. To me, that was absolutely shocking that someone would believe that. I really have the attitude that when Israel is fighting for Israel, we're fighting for Jews across the world. And I think people who think otherwise have a short memory. Like, just look back at what happened in the 1940s and what the difference would have been had there been in Israel. For people to say things like, oh, well, if Israel weren't there, that's really terrible, but not for me. I couldn't believe it.
Adding to that, when I had my Satmar guest on, it was a few months ago, but it wasn't about being Satmar. She talked about loss, but because she was Satmar, I had to ask her about Israel. So she gave us a little lowdown on that was similar lines of just being shocked that there are Jews who have a different experience when it comes to what's happening.
In a weird way, though, I'd almost say someone who's Satmar, at least they have a theological backing for it. They have consistently said, we don't believe in the state of Israel, and we think Israel is demonic. And as much as they think that's completely wrongheaded, at least they're consistent. For someone who's not in the Satmar world to think that Israel is, I think they're completely wrong. But for someone not in the Satmar world to say that, someone in the modern or centrist or even Haredi world to me, that was like, where is this coming from?
Back to the dynamic between Dati Lumi and Haredi, but there's also a dynamic between the secular Israelis and Dati Lumi. There's a disproportionate amount of combat soldiers that are Dati Lumi, and I think that's because they're more ideological, they're more idealistic, and they end up disproportionately on the front lines. Can you address that?
So I don't know the numbers. I've heard something similar. Certainly among those who've been tragically killed, it, again, without looking at the numbers in front of me, it certainly seems like so many have been from the national religious community. And I don't know the reason why. I think there is a sense of idealism. I know certainly I can speak about my own son, Yaakov, who's currently in training in the tank corps. He's down somewhere near Eilat in Shizafon is the name of the base there, the training base he's on. And he had the opportunity to not go if he didn't want to, meaning had he wanted to get some sort of medical exemption for allergies or whatever else, had he tried to do it, he probably could have gotten it. But it was not, it was something which simply was not, it did not enter his consciousness. And when anyone would mention it to him, he would say, I will always feel guilty if I don't do this. He felt a responsibility. So as a dad, I wish he'd taken the exemption, but as a dad, I'm also really proud that he didn't. I guess those two truths can coexist. And I'm very, very proud of him. And that's certainly true. And the fact is, I think that's probably a very common feeling among people in the national religious community, that if you really believe what you are saying, that this is a gift from Hashem, and this is the fulfillment, at least in part, of that which the prophets have told us about for so many years, then how could you not do your part? How can you try and get out of doing the most important part, which is defending the land? And it's also pikuach nefesh. Simply forget whether it's a melchemet mitzvah, a divinely mandated, Torah-mandated war. Simply the fact is, saving Jewish lives, there can't be a bigger mitzvah than that. And being in the Israeli army is part of that. If we're going to raise our children with a certain type of education, and then they take us up on it and take it seriously, and then say, you're right, the state of Israel is a gift from God, I'm going to help defend it, then that's the natural consequence. That's what's going to happen. And if that happens, we should consider ourselves validated that we've taught them those values. I'm not saying me personally. I mean the entire national religious community in Israel. So I think that is very true. And that's, I think, again, getting back to the other topic, I don't want to harp on it too much, but part of the frustration with some of the, I don't want to be sweeping, but with some of the people in the Haredi world is the fact that they don't have that same sense of responsibility. They don't have that same sense of, how can I save Jewish lives? How can I contribute to the Jewish community in that way? Or those who do say, we're doing it by learning Torah, I think a lot of them say that, and some even believe it. I don't know how many really believe it, but part of the problem is that I don't see any sources that show why that should be a real thing, and it's hard to respect it, given that we're looking at mitzvot in the Torah, in the Dati Lumi world. There's a melchemet mitzvah, there's a war that is mandated by the Torah, being attacked. Jews are being killed, Jews have been killed, Jews have been taken captive. If there isn't a melchemet mitzvah in this, I don't know what is. This is so clearly a requirement to go out there and save Jewish lives. To use that very clear statement in the Torah and in Chazal, and then contrast that with something nebulous like, well, Torah learning protects, which is true on some level, but if you point to a source that says, lots of people learning Torah instead of going to the army is a good thing, you're not going to find that source because it doesn't exist, at least not in Chazal and the Rishonim. So people like me say, it's very, very difficult to see our kids going out there. Like my son's only in training right now, but my son-in-law was in Gaza for about 80 days, you know, and my daughter would go for 2.5 weeks at a time without hearing from him. And to say, and he's in Kolo learning for Smicha, and he left Kolo to go back into the army to save Jewish lives. He was called up on October 7th and he left that day. So when other people say, yeah, but we're learning Torah and that's protecting you, for people like me, that can be a very difficult thing to absorb and to accept and to take seriously, given that we're pointing at sources and saying, this is what it says, and they're saying something without necessarily having the same sources to back it up, at least as I read those sources.
You could be learning Torah when you're not serving, meaning you're not in the army your entire life. It's a certain amount of time, and people stop learning Torah to eat dinner and to have ben hazman, whatever it is, people stop learning Torah. So this should be a justifiable reason to stop learning Torah temporarily.
Well, that's what I said about my son-in-law. He's also in Kolel. He's studying for Smicha in a Dati Lumi yeshiva. So why is his Torah learning not valuable enough that he can keep learning? That's how I see it.
That's the disvalidating of your Torah versus their Torah.
Exactly.
I said this when we were covering the topic of sexual abuse again, post October 7th. I remember thinking, you know, when things are so bad, we're back to basics. We're afraid for our lives for being Jewish. Forget about all the other issues that come up. We still have sexual abuse in our own backyards, and we still have all these other issues that are still happening. So when I was standing on an army base and we were one of the tour guides, well, soldiers who was giving us a tour, he said that they have a program for lone soldiers, but then he went to add on how that program for lone soldiers includes the Haredi young men who are ostracized and cut off from their families by joining post October 7th. And I was in such shock that post October 7th, you would have a family that would cut off their son, and to the point where they might need even more emotional support than a lone soldier who has a loving family, even though they can't go back to them, they still have them. Here you have someone who gave up their entire social circle that they grew up with. So that was a piercing moment from my trip.
I don't blame you.
Another thing that comes up, and I just did an interview, didn't go live yet, where the reason Haredim don't go to the army, and we'll lump the girls into that because they're Shirut Lumi, and Shirut Lumi is not the army. And the reason they don't is because it's a bad environment. It's inappropriate. It's going to ruin those precious souls that are very insular. Talk to me about that.
That's not a bad argument. It might be true. I hear that. And I'm not going to try and say that their fears are not valid. Of course they're valid. But there are several things that I have to say about that. Okay, their fears are valid, but I fear about that. I have the same fear for my child. But when you have an obligation, you can't look at the potential consequences. You have to look at your obligation. To me, one of the key ideas in Parshat Nitzavim, it says, "Hanisarot l'Hashem Elokeinu," the hidden things belong to God, "V'aniklot lanu ulavaneinu ad olam," but the revealed things are ours to do forever, "Lasot ha'kol divrei Torah hazot," to do this Torah. And at least as I understand that pasuk, that's telling us largely that we have to worry about what we do and let the chips fall where they may. That doesn't mean we can't take precautions, but basically in Judaism, the ends don't justify the means. You got to do what you got to do. When the Torah says you have to go and protect Jewish lives, the fact that it might be dangerous is a very, very serious problem, and we have to try and fix that. That doesn't change the fact that you have an obligation to take care of what you have to take care of, you know? And because of that, I hear the problem, but I don't understand why the solution is don't do your obligation. That seems to be an anti-Torah attitude to me. The second point I'll make about that, Freddie, is when people, I guess I'll put it like this, and this is something which when I talked to Rabbi Breidowitz Shlita on my podcast, I think he brought this up too on some level. So I think it's an important point. Let's say that's entirely true, and I fully accept that. Why aren't we looking for solutions rather than finding reasons why it won't work? In other words, I proposed on that podcast, I said, just al regel achad, on one leg, saying, why not have what we'll call the Haredi Corps? Right now, there is a Haredi division, but it's largely for kids who didn't make it in the Haredi world, kids who kids in yeshiva. What if we had, like they have Golani, they have Givati, they have Kfir, we'll call it Haredi, for lack of a better term. Now we have this Haredi Corps, which is developed in conjunction with Rosh Yeshiva and the IDF together. So it's not co-ed. So that's not going to be one of the problems. It's going to have an environment that Haredi Rosh Yeshiva will approve of. Yes, 75 years ago, the Israeli army was not a place for religious people. It was really anti-religious. And in some ways, it's true. They saw it as a means of assimilation. Now the army doesn't care about that. That's not, at least I don't think so. And if it does, let's make a division where that's not the problem. Or a division where that's not the goal. The goal is for them to maintain their Haredi identity. Let's say they're 22 years old. They've learned for 4 or 5 years. Now they go into the army into combat role. They actually go and do Kravi, combat. And the environment, well, they'll daven 3 times a day. I mean, my kid also davens 3 times a day, but this will be under a Haredi-style davening, whatever. We'll make sure that everything is Mahadrin, etc. Let's try and find solutions, ways that the environment will be conducive to Haredi lifestyles. And the problem is that I don't see people from the Haredi world coming forward and saying, well, if we could do something like that, then we're willing to join the IDF. And if they can't find a compromise, then we'll worry about that then. Let's at least try and find some sort of way that it can work for all of us. Let's try and find a way that we can be integrated and that it won't be an environment which will be bad for us. All the commanders will be Haredi people, etc. There are ways of doing it, at least ways we can imagine that it's possible. And Rabbi Breidowitz was saying that that idea is sound, but they'll never go for it. They'll never accept it. And that's the problem. I feel too often that there's no step forward in saying, hey, let's see if we can find a solution to it. Because saying it can't be done is easy. But when people are dying and people need help and the Israeli public needs more people out there and the Haredi people are not en masse making the same contribution, why not have the Haredi politicians and the Haredi leadership come forward and saying, let's look for a solution instead of saying, no matter what the answer is, no. That's part of the problem. So even if the problems are intractable now, let's look for solutions instead of trying just to say there's no solution, so therefore they're not going to join. And I'm disturbed by the fact that there aren't these attempts on both the IDF's part and the Haredi leadership's part to come to a middle ground where they can both get what they want.
The train of thought when you were talking about before, the obligation, the consequences that, what was the word you used?
I said that the ends don't justify the means.
Right. They view an obligation to learn Torah. They view an obligation not to ruin their children by sending them into co-ed environments. And that train of thought also kind of is the Haredi or the more ultra train thought when it comes to birth control, for example. Don't think about how you're going to support or take care of emotionally, physically, and financially of your children. Your obligation is to have children. So when you were explaining it, I was like, that's exactly how this is explained.
Yeah, I guess the question is, when you look at an obligation, you can always turn the ends into an obligation. My obligation is to make sure this doesn't happen. Okay, that's sort of, I understand what you mean. That's probably part of the thought process where you're saying my obligation is to make sure my kids don't go off the derech. Okay, got it. So you've basically taken the consequence and turned it into an obligation instead. All right, but we have to look at this and say, what does the Torah say in any given situation? Does the Torah say learn instead of going to the army? No, that's not what the Torah says. The Torah has many laws about going to the army, and the Torah has many laws about fighting, and the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that David HaMelech couldn't have learned if Yoav, his general, had not been fighting, and Yoav couldn't have fought if David HaMelech hadn't been learning. Okay, so let's even use that as a source for learning matters too, but there's no assumption that learning replaces army altogether for everybody. That's not what it says there at all. First of all, it's not legal anyway. It's not a piece of legal Gemara. But even leaving that aside, there has to be an army. There has to be fighting. And if there's going to be fighting, to say that we're not going to take that obligation at all, ki hu zeh, full stop, I find that an abrogation of duty, in my opinion.
And I want to put it out there that I am living not in Israel and I don't have children in the army or a husband in the army. So as much as I'm criticizing the Haredi world, I'm not in your shoes either. So I want that out there.
And by the way, I'm not criticizing the Haredi world en masse. I really am not, because that's too sweeping a reduction, so it's not fair. But I think that the leadership, I'm not speaking about specific people, but some of the leadership has to do a better job, because the Haredi political leadership, and I'll say this without any problem, is a complete disaster. And I think they're leading them down into a place where they don't belong. And we need new leadership on the religious level too, but certainly on the political level. And I think it's not so much the Haredi public as the fact that they've got some leaders who are not doing what's right by them, even for them.
But there are a lot of successful grassroots operations and initiatives. So there is hope for the starting bottom up.
This is not about criticizing any individual out there. There are lots of wonderful people, you know, probably most of my friends here are Haredi. I'm not coming from an anti-Haredi perspective. The Shul I daven in, Shachris Min Chamarev, is a reasonably Haredi shul. I say reasonably Haredi because it's more Haredi than Dati Lumi. It's somewhere in the middle, but more Haredi. You know, I've got no problem with people who are Haredi. I think that this particular aspect of that Haredi lifestyle needs a reimagining.
I just can't imagine you walking into shul every day and these are your friends, your neighbors, and you're not criticizing their beliefs and choices.
Well, I'd say I'm disagreeing with their beliefs and choices, but you know, I'm not going to necessarily, they probably disagree with my beliefs and choices too. I'm sure they do. So that's okay. We can live together. And until October 7th, I don't think anyone really thought about it too much, because what difference does it make? Like in this particular shul, until October 7th, the shul I daven in on Shabbos is a much more dati lumi shul. But, and what I call my shul, the shul I daven in during the week is about a 90-second walk from my front door. So that's why I daven there. And until October 7th, they would never say the tefillah for the soldiers, the mishaberach for the soldiers. Starting on October 7th, they changed that. They actually added that. And that means it's not even so Haredi. It's more Haredi light, because a true dyed-in-the-wool Haredi place would not have said that, I don't think. I think they would say Tehillim, but they wouldn't say a tefillah for soldiers, and a tefillah, a mishaberach for soldiers, and here they do. So I think it's just a matter of dealing with people and saying, each person, basher husham, where that person is, we're all trying to do the best we can. And I can disagree with choices, but it doesn't mean you're sinister. You're trying to do something because you're a bad person. This is, I think your choices might be wrong, but that doesn't mean that you're a bad person. Obviously, we're all trying to do the best we can.
Thank you for talking about this topic with me. It's a heavy one, so thank you for going there with me. I want to end off by asking you what your ideas or expectations or visions are for the space in the Orthodox Taboo podcast conversations. Like, what movements have emerged? I know influencers online are in a similar space and movements have emerged, and you agree with some of them and some don't. I know there's a lot of new GET-related initiatives that are raising a lot of eyebrows. What are some expectations or future trends or movements that you see happening because of the space we're in?
I am hopeful that the space we're in will help create grassroots change. As you mentioned a moment ago, a lot of the people who are coming from the bottom up in the Haredi community are doing things that the leadership may not be doing. That's true everywhere. And all our communities do wonderful things and have things that need a lot of reworking. And I think that the influencers, podcasts, videos, people who are working who are not part of those institutions have an opportunity to try and change things by creating a groundswell of support for it. So I certainly am hopeful that some of the institutions which are dominant and some of the organizations which are dominant, and organizations and institutions are often interested in self-perpetuation. Their goal is, for good reasons, I used to run a yeshiva, our goal was self-perpetuation too. You want to remain in existence. I understand it. I don't begrudge it. I don't criticize it. But it sometimes means that certain issues get swept under the rug or ignored or aren't handled properly as a result of that. I'm hoping that will change. And maybe a de-emphasis on some of these institutions, or perhaps replacing them with better institutions or even non-institutions, maybe less rigid institutions, less denominational institutions on some level even, might be a healthy thing for Judaism in general and Orthodoxy in particular. There is a drawback, though, because sometimes I have found when dealing with certain people who are not experts, and I'm not calling myself an expert, I'm saying I'm part of the problem too, sometimes people will look at solutions and say, you know, we have to go and fix this, and this is terrible, and I don't see why it's working like this, and you create this, you know, this mob with torches, metaphorically speaking, running towards the castle, when you don't understand that the things being done in there, maybe it's not right, but doesn't mean your answer is a better answer or might make things even worse. I remember many years ago, I worked in a certain place and I remember they spent money on something, which I thought was ridiculous. I can't believe they're spending money on this when they're firing teachers, whatever the case was exactly. And later on, when I ran my own yeshiva, I said, oh, I would do the exact same thing as they did. Because looking at it from the other side of the desk, you understand things better. And I'm afraid sometimes that people who are podcasters, influencers, whatever, we come up with these solutions. And it's so easy for us to say, oh, they should do it like this. They should do it like this because I'm not the one responsible for the decision should it go bad. So I sometimes worry that there are people who are influencers who are trying to do good things, but don't necessarily have the knowledge to realize that it's not quite so simple, whether the halachic knowledge, whether the institutional knowledge, whether the organizational experience to understand that sometimes the solutions you're suggesting might actually make things worse rather than better. And in a world where everybody's opinion is equally valid, which is the world of social media in which we live, that is a fear that I often grapple with. What if the solutions that we're suggesting, which seem so obvious, are they've been rejected by people who simply know better? Could be that they're tied in by their institution, they're stuck. Or it could be they just simply know more than we do and we don't realize it yet.
God put different people in different places with different perspectives for a reason.
And have a little bit of humility, I think, is a big part of it. We all have to have humility because once someone is arrogant and thinks they know everything, oy vavoy lenu, we're in trouble.
Okay, last question. Can you think of a story or an example of something dramatic that happened over your podcasting journey?
Yeah.
That you're able to share?
Yeah, no, it's still hard for me to talk about. And this isn't even something dramatic that happened as a result of a podcast. It was the podcast was a result of something dramatic. This is still very difficult for me to talk about, even though it's almost 3 years later, when my closest childhood friend died. And he died alone in an apartment in Boston. And it was a complete shock for me. And in some ways was one of the most intense grieving experiences I've ever had on a personal level, just in so many ways. I wasn't even in such regular touch with him. But something touched me in a very, very deep and personal way when that happened. And I decided that the way that I would memorialize him was to put out a podcast. And I made an episode. I recorded sort of a monologue, about half an hour or so, I think, where I talked about him for half an hour. And it didn't take away my grief, but it was extremely cathartic and it was very meaningful for me personally. And I hope for other people also, just being able to contend with that grief publicly. I'm not sure that's such a dramatic thing, but it was dramatic for me in the sense of I've never been so moved by an event and so driven to record it that way. And I just felt that by recording it, I was able to say goodbye to him in a certain way.
That's really beautiful. So let me rephrase, because you didn't answer my question. What's the most juicy behind the scenes story you can share with us? I guess women use the word dramatic to describe juicy.
What do you mean by behind the scenes then?
I can think of my own many examples. So I don't know what your example would be, but a classic example being a guest not being happy with where the episode went, or some feeling like you misrepresented them or they misrepresented themselves, or just that kind of drama happening from an episode that you did.
So I once did an episode with somebody. I don't want to give away too many details out of a sense of privacy for them. They later on begged me to take it down, which I did. The reason they asked me to take it down was because they were involved in a lawsuit and there couldn't be any information about, they had recorded the podcast, this particular person had recorded the podcast about the events of the lawsuit before the lawsuit had been filed. And as a result of that, later on, their lawyer said, get that thing down. And it had been a very popular episode. So I wasn't thrilled about taking it down, but obviously out of respect for my guests, I took it down for them. So I said, sure, no problem. There's currently if you go through the numbers of my podcast, there's one number missing over there. And if you just count them up because of that. So that was a good example of something that was, someone took it down. Other times people have said, I don't think people were usually unhappy about the way something was represented. But I will say this, that maybe another example of this was, you asked me at the very beginning of our conversation about people giving me pushback. So there was a case at the beginning of Intimate Judaism, where when I first started recording it, there was a couple students got very, very upset by it. They didn't know what was happening with me. These are students who'd become much more ultra-Orthodox in the time since they'd left my yeshiva. So because of that, one particular student just started trashing me on Facebook. Now, I didn't really care, but because it's one student, and what am I going to say? But I was a little bit shocked. I was a little bit shocked that this student would I said, really? Like, I understand you don't approve what I'm doing, but let's say I had one of my own teachers and I didn't like what they were doing. I think I would express it to them privately. Or maybe say, this is somebody else's fight, simply because we had a great relationship. I'd been his teacher. I'd been his Gemara Rebbe. So I guess that was another example where he just was trashing me on Facebook. But I think later on he got married and grew up a little bit and he stopped trashing me. So it's okay now.
Thank you so much for doing this conversation, this podcast with me.
Well, I want to thank you. This was a lot of fun. I really appreciate it. You asked great questions and it's always a pleasure to talk to you. So thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening until the end. I hope you have an easy fast. I hope you have a beautiful Purim. Check out the other podcasts on the Jewish Coffee House Network. And of course, as always, I love hearing from you. I love your feedback. If you'd like to join the WhatsApp group, you can message me as well. And see you next time.